Welcome back to part two of our seminar. We're going to start now with a word to parents. Let me read to you a letter that a senior teenager wrote to her mum following her parents' divorce. This contains some really wonderful insights from a recovering victim's point of view. She writes, "Dear Mama, I want to thank you for so many things. You have given yourself unreservedly to me. You have tried so hard and loved me so much. And you have done so many things right, things I hear other parents mess up, that I am amazed. Thank you for talking to my brother and me. Thank you for not hiding the fact that you and Dad are human and make mistakes. You had the wisdom to know we felt uncomfortable already. You understood that we, although we were kids, weren't stupid. We could tell that something was wrong, so you leveled with us. You were honest and you talked to us. Communication, knowing how bad things really were, was much easier to bear than the agony of suspense. Thank you for not waiting until the kids are married off," quote. "An action like that wouldn't have been fair to you or Dad or to us. You realised we sensed the wrongness of our family relationship. You faced the fact that you were sticking it out just until we were gone wouldn't have solved anything. Because of your action, I don't suffer any delusion that your relationship with Dad was the ideal. And I know that it wasn't as good as a marriage could be, and with that knowledge, I can try and have a better relationship with my future husband. You also taught me by your example that marriage is sacred. Everything should be done to make it work. You showed me the lengths to which one should go to make it succeed before calling it quits. But sometimes staying in a relationship can be more damaging to everyone concerned than ending it. Sometimes a divorce is the lesser of two evils, and you showed me about the courage to end it. Through your actions, I know that lancing an infected sore can hurt a lot, but sometimes it's the only way to bring healing to the body. You also gave me plenty of encouragement. You were emphatic in your assurance to me that I was not to blame for the divorce. You knew that the children are the ones who often blame themselves for marriage failures, and you therefore did your best to make me realize that your divorce was not my fault. Thank you for telling me over and over that I was still a respectable person and that my family was still respectable too. You told me that just because our family was separated, it didn't make them broken or any less legitimate. You talked to me about my feelings. You took the time to listen and to ask when I was afraid to talk about the emotions I was experiencing. Children often feel insecure about their niche in society, their surroundings, their self-worth. You not only assured me of my worth as the product of a divorce, but you had the courage to tell me about your feelings. You were courageous enough to show me that you weren't superhuman. You weren't perfect. You made mistakes, and you were insecure and lonely and scared too. By your disclosure, I not only admired you, I felt closer to you because we felt the same way, and I knew that my feelings were legitimate because you had the same ones. Thank you, oh, thank you so much for not trying to get me to take sides between you and Dad. I had so much to think about then. The last thing I would have needed was to hear a scathing criticism of my father and try and sort out which critiques were legitimate and which were the products of an angry heart. You had the wisdom to discuss personality traits and bad habits, both yours and his, that I should avoid both in myself and in a future spouse without personally attacking Dad. You also stated good traits that you both possessed. When we were examining your past relationship, you made it clear that the flaws were exactly that, flaws. They were not a denunciation of person that we both loved, but flaws in a character. Through this kind of objective examination, I learned what not to do, but I was also able to love both of you and not decide which parent was good and which parent was bad. Thank you for this fairness. You prayed with me. I already knew God, but you helped me know him even better in troubled times. With your help and by your example, I learned how to depend on him during heartaches. Because of you, I could see how he helps when we need him most. Thank you for not underestimating the power and legitimacy of counselling. By getting it yourself, you showed me that going to a psychologist is not for crazy people, but for people who need to talk things over with a specialist. It's true I didn't get counselling then, but now I wouldn't be afraid of it if I needed some. Even though I didn't take you up on the offer, you understood the helpfulness of counselling, and you offered to pay for it if I wanted it. Thanks. You follow your own rules. If you tell me to be careful whom I date, you are just as careful, if not more so. If you tell me to eat right, you make sure you do. If you tell me not to stay up late, you also go to bed at a reasonable hour. I've some friends who are completely disgusted with their parents because now that the parents are dating again, they're breaking all the rules that they set for their children. I don't blame them for being upset. Thank you for being so consistent. You decided with Dad and with me where I would live, and then you stuck with it. You didn't subject me to the confusion of being shuffled back and forth between you and him. I really feel sorry for my friends who never know when one parent will get tired of them and send them to the other one. I also sympathize with the ones who have confusing relationships, like living with each parent 1 month at a time. Oh, how awful! You'd have to have 2 shampoos, 2 hairdryers, 2 wardrobes. Your friends would never know which number to call. Your mail would always come to the wrong address. Thank you for letting me see Dad, but giving me the security of having a home, and always the same one. Thank you for not moving from the area right away. Many times I know it's easier to move to a new location, one that doesn't contain all the friends and the memories and the symbols of the old married life. But you waited. You knew that even though it could get uncomfortable, there was already a surplus of the new and the scary in our family. The last thing we needed to contend with was a new town, new acquaintances, new school, new everything. After we got used to our changed status, and after I graduated from high school, then we moved. Now I'm glad we did, because we needed to make a fresh start, but thank you for having the sensitivity to wait. Basically, Mum, thanks for having the sensitivity and honesty and love in all the decisions you made. Thank you for depending on God so much that he helped you know the right thing to do. Thank you for giving so much love to me and for caring so much for my welfare. I'm very proud to be called your daughter and consider myself very fortunate to call you Mama. Love, Laurie. Laurie Visa's letter was reproduced in her book, Standing on an Earthquake, from Review and Herald, a publishing company, Idaho. Let's spend a few moments now talking about stepfamilies. Of course, there's a danger at this juncture to try and cover a subject which warrants a seminar all of its own. However, there are a few relevant issues which could be discussed here. Step-parenting brings out the difference between marriage and parenthood. Tales of wicked stepmothers abound in classical literature. In 1892, the British folklorist Marion Rolfe catalogued 345 variations of the story of Cinderella. One of the most popularised versions, the 1697 Perrault Cinderella, reproduced in part in Brenda Maddox's book, Step Parenting, opens with these following lines. Listen to the picture of grandmother in this, of stepmother in this. There once was a man whose wife had died and left him to bring up her own child. A little daughter who was sweet and gentle by nature and as pretty a girl as ever could be. Father and daughter lived happily enough together until the man married again. His new wife was a proud and masterful woman with two plain daughters who were as arrogant and disagreeable as she was herself. As you will recall, Hansel and Gretel and Snow White and the Seven Dwarves didn't escape the wicked stepmother syndrome. Wicked stepfathers also appear in literature, such as the King in Shakespeare's Hamlet and Mr. Murdstone in Charles Dickens's David Copperfield. Add to that the incongruity that step-parenting begins with a wedding. Is it any wonder that our expectations of step-familyhood is a little shaky? Of course, this need not be so, as so many absolutely wonderful examples of step-family successes abound. However, it is well to be aware that there are potential difficulties. Stepfathers may suffer the vagueness of fatherhood and stepmothers the explicitness of motherhood. Stepfathers usually find it easier to love another's children, yet the proverbial child with a face only a mother could love imposes difficulties for some stepmothers. Many women are reluctant to admit that reprogenesis governs their emotions just as much as many men are too proud to accept the additional financial support from a birth father for his wife's children. Stepfamilies have a marginally greater problem with incest, abuse, sibling rivalry, and the Christian love ethic is the greatest safeguard. Like fighting cancer, seeking help before the problem explodes into pain is a wise strategy. Now, we're going to take a break for 15 minutes for refreshments to allow some time for you to write down any questions that you may have. When we return together, we're going to screen the video Divorce Can Happen to the Nicest People. And then after the video, we're going to spend some time answering your questions. So if you'd like to write your questions out now, we will discuss them when we return, straight after the video. Thank you very much. Thank you. Okay, very good. Right. We have a couple of questions here which we will address now. And the other question is a rather personal one. And I will get the person that wrote the third question, you'll know which it is when we come to it. It's the one that somebody handed in and is not addressed. If that person can come and see me afterwards, we'll arrange a time where that can be resolved on a very personal level. We have this question here with regard to soul parenting. Where do the children fit in? Children are our responsibility, and they're going to be grieving whether the soul parenting is due to a partner's death, penal incarceration, sickness, disability, separation, or divorce. And the question asks, well, where do they fit in? Or I presume this is meaning, what can we do to help? Well, there's a number of things. Firstly, we can reassure them that the problems are not their fault. They are not to blame. We can reassure them too that although circumstances have changed, your love for them has not. Actively reinforce the expression of your continued commitment and love for them. If you no longer have a commitment to the marriage, remind them that you still have a commitment to them. However, don't overcompensate. Do you understand what I mean there? While encouraging a positive outcome from present circumstances, we also need to discourage any false hopes or fantasies. After the divorce, Dad is not going to come back, is he? After a death, Mum is not going to return to the family. Restrain yourself from unloading your excessive emotional baggage on the children. It's very easy to do when you're alone in the house, apart from the children being there, when your partner's no longer there, to give them all your emotional baggage. It's good if you can shield them from unnecessary suffering resulting from the conflict that you have between the parents. Never should they be used as instruments of revenge. For their sakes, to avoid further confusion and pain, choose not to denigrate or put down the other parent in front of them. Irrespective of your feelings, they may still love the other parent. Take some time to actively listen to them, their needs, their feelings. Tell them it's okay to be angry because their circumstances help them to seek ways to express that anger, to creatively deal with it. If you're having a problem with anger, we have a cassette tape specifically on this topic of anger. If access arrangements are made, consider the children's needs and their feelings. Even involve a third party to collect them and return them if necessary. Too often we hear of examples where because the parents don't want to meet each other, They just leave the children in the driveway. Don't use gifts to woo love, allegiance, or respect. Don't use them as pawns in your life games. We have another cassette that you're may be interested in too, entitled Conflict Resolution. No, don't use the children as pawns. They should not have to be used as talebearers or take sides. They shouldn't need to relay messages or gather intelligence. Also at this time, it might be wise to contact their teachers at the school and advise them of the changed circumstances, so that they can expect this period of changed behaviour, maybe even rebellion, while the child is grieving. And finally, I would suggest an answer to this question would be to seek professional help, if necessary, for the children, as well as for yourself. Now, remember I said there was three questions and we're narrowing them down. And the second question that I want to address now, someone has asked the question, how can I have some friends without having an affair? Now, I guess the answer to this question would be slightly different if we're talking about a marriage relationship and having friends outside that relationship, or a divorced person or separated person having friends. But the basic principles, I guess, remain the same. So we'll talk about those basic principles now. In McGuinness's book, The Friendship Factor, he lists half a dozen principles there, and I might share those with you now. I mightn't get the order quite right, but there's something like this. Number one, don't trust yourself too far. Be aware of the ebb and the flow of your sexual desire. Most of us vary greatly in the amount of sexual feeling we have. And at times its power can rush in on us if we're not prepared. If your sexuality is at flood tide, then exercise extra caution. Secondly, select companions who have strong marriages themselves. If your friend is hungry for love, it may be difficult to keep the friendship within bounds. Thirdly, you can be sensible about when and where you meet when you're alone. Some settings are more sexual than others. Lunch, for instance, is not as likely to lead to trouble as dinner in a restaurant filled with lovers eating by candlelight. If you're in a marriage situation and you're talking about friends outside the marriage, then talk to your mate about your friendships. When meetings become clandestine, secretive, it's a danger signal, a warning that things are getting out of hand. Either bring yourself to tell your spouse about the progression of the friendship or get out. Fifthly, draw a line on physical contact. Find the amount of physical affection that is comfortable and safe for you. Since no one can stay in control once sexual touching and kissing cross a certain boundary. And finally, and you mightn't like this one, bail out if necessary. Once in a while, no matter how much we try, a friendship with the opposite sex may get out of hand. And we know where it's going to lead. If your marriage is precious to you, there is no question what must be done. However great the pain, back out. Now, someone asked me in closing to share with you the poem that I had right at the beginning. And I'll just go through that once more now, in closing. Maggie gives a sideways glance as she shares the secrets of her romance. The lights are low, there's music on, the setting's romantic, he'll soon be home. I hope he likes it, we'll wait and see. And he comes with a package for me. I hope it's roses red, picked just for me. No, it's only a red cabbage to cook for his tea. But still I am hopeful, with soft candle lights and dreamy sweet music for dreamy delights. Coat on the floor, as he looks around, on go the lights, off goes the sound. Well, he starts bleating in tired grumpy tone, I like to see what I'm eating in my own home. Now the TV is blaring and gone are my wishes. I reach out my loving arms into a sink full of dishes. When I tried to communicate, I just talked to myself. So he bought me some chocolates, then ate them himself. He's good at suggesting to grant my every wish. When I suggest cooking dinner, he buys chips and fish. So here I am sulking, 'cause the TV is cuter. I dread when my Egbert buys a computer. Egbert says yes when I ask him to help, but he's still sitting still while I do it myself. So I go off to bed, all alone, all alone. Where's Egbert, my husband? The romance is gone, but he's still attached to the old lounge room sofa. I wonder about life when his life is over. Oh, perish the thought. I don't wish him dead. I only wish he was living instead. He's now good for nothing. There's only one course. I'll pawn off the kids and get a divorce. It's my prayer that none of you ever get to a situation where divorce is the only course of action. And for those of you who have made that choice already, I hope you have benefited from our program today, looking at some of the ways of recovering from divorce. Thank you very much.